Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
We're going to be in chapters 36 and 37 today. Remember, we're in a period of restoration. It hasn't happened. It's just been prophesied. It's a word of hope to the exiles. Chapter 36 and 37 are a good example of historical foreshadowing. Let me just say to you that I guess chapter 37 is one of the most famous chapters in Ezekiel. It's often been used and interpreted in light of the commentator's bias about eschatological events. I must admit to you, I have a bias. I'm trying to get it all out of the Bible in the sense of I'm trying to let the Bible speak to me instead of me reading what I already know it's supposed to say into it. But it's going to be obvious that I'm biased here. Everybody is. So I hope you'll read these chapters in light of the Old Testament first. Don't read your full-blown New Testament eschatology into here. Let this speak first. And once you have properly studied this in light of its own day, then apply the systematic truth of the whole Bible to it. But let it speak itself first. Okay? Now, let's begin on chapter 36. We have a personification in 36 of the mountains of Israel and the land of Israel, the promised land. It is spoken to as if it were a person, and it is admonished to bless and not curse the repentant Israelites that come back home. And that's the theme throughout chapter 36. I want you to notice that God addresses the mountains in verse 1. He does that quite often, sometimes for different reasons. Often he addresses them as witnesses, because mountains are used in the sense of that which is permanent, that which is lasting. And so the heavens and earth are called on to witness God's judgment or promises or whatever. Here, though, we're not really in that context of a witness. He is addressing them to be a means of blessing. And here we saw it last week, it's the eschatological blessings of the future on the land. It goes back to Deuteronomy 27 and 28, where if they would keep the covenant, they would have unbelievable agricultural blessings, have many children. If they broke them, there would be disastrous curses on fertility, both of men, beast, and the land. And so here we have that picked up. Now in verse 2, you may have the everlasting heights have become our possession. Now the word heights is the word bema or bemoth here, plural. It's the word used for the fertility worship places that you call the high places. There was a play on that back in chapter 20, verse 29. So what it's saying is the very places of the worship of the fertility God have become the places of the worship of Yahweh. So there's been a total orientation away from idolatry and on to God and only God, the Yahweh of the covenant. Now, in verse 3, God comes back to say, there's real cause why you were persecuted and you were taken into captivity. And it says, for good cause they have made you desolate and crushed you from every side. And that was their sin, and primarily the sin of idolatry. And that idolatry issued in the abominational practices of the Amorites, that's exactly why God took them out of the land. You might see Genesis 15:16. God's no respecter of persons. When Israel did what the Canaanites did, God took them out of the land too. Now, notice where it mentions that they had become a talk and a whispering of the peoples. Now, literally here, it means the lip of the tongue. This seems to mean foreigners. Now, it could mean the surrounding nations are talking about how God has blessed or judged Israel. Or it could mean the foreign invaders are talking about God has blessed or cursed Israel. It's simply a reaffirmation that God is using Israel as a kingdom of priests. They are witness. They are light. They are salt. If they'll be faithful, they'll be positive. If they won't, it's going to be negative. But God's using them to show the world who He is in covenant blessings and promises, or who He is in covenant disobedience. Israel is an instrument or a light of God to the earth. Now, she is today to some extent. Now, notice where it mentions in verse 5, my jealousy. Well, that's a love word. It's the idea of God as husband. All of the titles for God are intimate terms, family terms, husband, parent, a kinsman redeemer, Goel. All of them describe God in those very intimate personal relationships. Here it's the idea of God as lover, book of Hosea. Now notice that against all Edom is mentioned. Chapter 35 is the prophecies against Edom and her taking advantage of the calamity that fell upon Judah. Now, notice where it says in verse 7, I have sworn, and this means to lift up the hand to swear. You might want to see chapter 20 where it's used so often. God swears by himself. It's his way of affirming that he will do what he says he'll do. Now, let's see. Notice in verse 8, as the mountains of Edom were judged in chapter 35, the mountains of Israel will be blessed. And you might want to see Matthew 35, 3, 7, 15. Okay? Notice the house of Israel will be reunited in verse 10. No more split tribes. One house of Israel again. You can read this chapter. There's not a whole lot involved here that we haven't covered before. So I'm just hitting the high points. Notice the a woman's menstrual cycle is mentioned in verse 17 as being an abominable thing as far as having sexual relations during that time. And I want to say again, we need to realize that they're not speaking medically here. They're speaking religiously, ceremonial purity. All bodily emissions, be it male emissions, nocturnal emissions, be it menstrual periods, be it childbirth, be it the oozing of a sore, whatever, made someone ceremonially unclean. And that's the background of this. We need to see that. Now, in verse 18, it talks about the blood which they've shed. This could refer to the child sacrifice of Molech, or it could refer to the righteous being killed for political or economic gain. Or it could refer to the fact they were just killing one another in greed. And one of those fits here. Notice in verse 19, according to their ways and their deeds, I have judged them. Friends, I want to tell you Galatians 6, 7 is a powerful verse for men and nations and societies where it says, be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man or a nation or a society or a tribal group sows, that shall they reap. Now, it continues then where it says, they profane my holy name. Now remember, Israel was chosen to be an instrument to reveal God. So the way Israel lived said something about God. And God was greatly concerned that his name had been impugned. The very fact that Israel was taken into captivity was a negative word about God, because all the people were connected to a national god, and Marduk was the Babylonian god, and the moon god Zen, and all of those said, well, they're stronger than Yahweh, because look, they've captured Yahweh's people. But God was willing for his name to be impugned that his people might return to personal faith in him. Because he's going to show the world who he is. He showed Egypt in the plagues. He's going to show Assyria. He's going to show Babylon. He's going to show Persia. God's in control of history, but his name is tied to his people. Now, that's true of the church. We are the only Bible people are going to ever read, and they know something about God from the way we live. It's according to believers. That's an awesome responsibility. God's reputation is talked about in verse 21. In verse 22, it says, I'm going to act because of my namesake, not because of who you are. Now, you ought to see Deuteronomy 9, 6. God did not choose the Jews because they were so wonderful. He chose them because they were just the opposite. They were stiff-necked, rebellious, haughty people. But his grace showed all the brighter amidst their rebellion. And so that's why he chose them. Notice that you have profaned among the nations where you went. Boy, that hurts, doesn't it? They didn't deserve God's grace. They deserved judgment, but they got grace. Then verse 23 and following, I was amazed at how many times God said, I will, I will. Just mark in your Bible, look at that. God, I will, I will, I will, I will, I will. There is a sense, now I hope you'll hear this paradox, on the unconditional promises of God. There is a sense in the conditional promises of man's response. But here God is saying, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to put a new heart within you. I'm going to put a new spirit within you. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. Unconditional promises. God's initiating grace. Now, man's response will come into it, but here's the power of the initiating grace of God. I will bring it to pass. The nations will know that I'm the Lord. In verse 25, we have sprinkled clean. What a beautiful metaphor back from the Old Testament metaphor. Numbers 19, 17 through 19, sprinkled with either the blood or the water of cleansing or the ash of the red heifer, whatever. Notice in verse 26 now, I'm going to put a new heart and a new spirit within you. Now, here is a paradox I want you to see. Remember I talked about the unconditional covenant and the conditional covenant. I often talk about the grace of God and the response of man. Now, both are here. This is an emphasis on God's initiating action. The same emphasis is seen in Jeremiah 31, 31 through 34. The same emphasis is seen in Ezekiel 11, 19. But the balance of human responsibility is where the same phrase is mentioned in chapter 18, 31, where it says, make yourself a new heart. Make yourself a new spirit. Yes, God's going to do it, but man must allow him to do it. And so in all religious activity, it's the initiating grace of God and the faith response of man in everything across the board. Now, this new heart and new spirit are going to be different. It's the new covenant. The old covenant of outward laws did not work because of man's fallen nature. So God's going to change the inside, and that's going to express itself on the outside. Now, a heart of flesh means a soft heart towards God instead of a hardness towards God, okay? Now, where it says, I will put my spirit within you, this is an obvious reference to the New Age. The coming of the Spirit was a sign of the New Age. It's mentioned throughout the Old Testament. You might want to see Ezekiel 37:14, 39:29. Isaiah 42:1, Isaiah 44:3, Isaiah 59:21, Joel 2:28-29. The coming of the indwelling Spirit is a sign of the new covenant, the new age. Now there was, I've often heard people say, well, the Spirit came upon people in the old, but indwelt the new. That's too simplistic. There are many times the Spirit indwells people in the Old Testament before Pentecost. So you can't make that simplistic of a statement. But God's going to do a new thing. He's going to work within from man's attitudes out instead of from without rules in. We need to hear that as legalists, I tell you what. Now, notice it says, my people, and I'll be your God. Verse 28, there are those covenant promises mentioned again. The covenant curses are mentioned in verse 29. If you will, I'll bless you. Deuteronomy 27. If you won't, verse 29, I'll curse you. Deuteronomy 28. Now, notice it says, and then you will remember your evil ways and your deeds that were not good, and you will loathe yourselves. Boy, here's repentance. The covenant people turn to God. That's why I don't think that modern Israel is necessarily the fulfillment of this prophecy. We're going to get up to 37 more. Because modern Israel is a secular state. It's not a repentant religious state that's turning to God. No, it's a secular state. Now, it's claiming its Jewishness and it's claiming its Old Testament privileges. But I have real problems with that because most of the Jews that are in leadership in Israel today have nothing to do with the literal seed of Abraham. They are the converted tribe of the Khazars that came from Europe in the Middle Ages. 9th century A.D., a whole European tribe converted to Judaism, changed their alphabet to Hebrew characters. We call it Yiddish now. Man, those are the ones who came, who were killed during the Holocaust of the Jewish Holocaust of the Nazi period. So this modern Israel is not the racial seed of Abraham. It's not at all. So I'm not 100% sure these promises apply to modern Israel. I know that's a radical truth, and I'm not sure if Judaism is a religion or a nationality. But these promises are only going to fit a repentant Israel, turning to God, not a secular state in the arrogance and pride of their heart. No, ain't no way. Now, be ashamed and be confounded for your ways. We must recognize our sin before the good news is good news. There's bad news before good news, always. Now, notice, I'm going to go to chapter 37. It is hard for me to believe that Ezekiel totally jumps the return from exile and speaks only of end-time events in chapter 37. But when I say that, I want to say to you, it is obvious that later in this chapter, chapter 20, verse 24 and following, we're talking about a divinic, a restored Messiah. It is obvious that this chapter has both a historical setting and a futuristic setting. We call it historical foreshadowing or prophetic foreshadowing. It's where something happened in history, but God uses that to explain what's going to happen in the end. Now, I want to say to you, there's a lot of weird theology based on this. British Israel's based on this some, a lot of millennial positions. In history, this must initially refer to national restoration of the exiles. So we're talking about the restoration under Cyrus. But because the everlasting kingdom is mentioned, because the divinic Messiah is mentioned, it's got to refer to end-time events, too. You say, well, tell me exactly where one leaves off and the other starts. That's what I can't do. Both are present. Both are true. But only the Spirit of God and the generation of fulfillment will know which is which. Now, the metaphor throughout here is not resurrection. It's national restoration. This chapter has nothing to do with the New Testament doctrine of resurrection. Nothing. It has to do with the metaphor of national resurrection. Now, the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me by the Spirit. Now, I want to show you something. Notice the word spirit in verse 1, the word breath in verse 5, the word breath in verse 6, the word breath in verse 8, the word breath several times in verse 9, the word wind in verse 9, the word breath in verse 10, the word spirit in verse 14 are all the same Hebrew word, ruah, which is exactly equivalent to the Greek New Testament term pneuma. Now, it is a fluid term. It can mean wind, it can mean breath, it can mean spirit. When it says that God breathed into man the breath of life, that's the word ruah. So it's a play on this word. It is the power of the wind that moves and man can't see, John 3. But it is also the breath of life in man, but it's also the Spirit of God, and it can mean any one of those. It's a play on that word throughout this. Now, when it says in the middle of the valley, now, this is the same Hebrew word used in chapter 3, verse 22, which is a scene for these visions that Ezekiel's had of the chariot throne of God. It's the same valley where God's chariot throne came, is this national restoration is going to occur. Now, some have said it's the place of slaughter. And then we'll see Jeremiah 7:32, maybe like the valley of the sons of Hinnom or the scene of a great battle. I don't know. But it's a special place, a valley. Notice where in verse, 3, it says, Son of man, can these bones live? And he answered, O God, thou knowest. This seems to me about this prophecy over these bones in verse 4, and they're going to come back to life and flesh is going to come on them and all. This seems to be very parallel to chapter 36 about give them a new heart, which is the ideal of a new flesh, a new body, a new attitude. Now notice there's two stages of this prophecy. A new heart, but that's not going to solve it, and a new spirit. Now, the new spirit seems to be when God says, prophesy to the spirit to breathe into them the breath of life. It's like a recreation, Genesis 2:7, all over again. So we have these two stages. A physical restoration and a spiritual restoration must occur. Now, maybe that is synonymous with the new heart is a more of a physical thing and a new spirit is more of an attitudinal, inner attitude, religious thing toward God. Maybe these two chapters are paralleling that. I'm just not sure, but I think there's some validity there. So in verses 3, 4, and 5, we have the idea of a new heart from back in 36. But in 8, 9, and 10, we have the idea of a new indwelling spirit from 36:27. Let's see. Notice in verse 11, it says, we are completely cut off. You see, they're just worried and upset and over, has God forsaken us? Is the covenant over? Are we cut off? Is there no hope? And Ezekiel's saying there is national hope. God is going to restore the covenant with the nation of Israel. It's going to be more individualistic than corporate. It's going to be even better than you knew before. It's going to be an internal spirit and faith more than external rules. But it's coming. Boy, what a great hope this was to those folks. Now, notice where it mentions here in verse 17. I want to pick up on a word study if I could. Notice where it says, by the way, verse 15, he starts a new metaphor about the rejoining of the houses of Israel and Judah. They split in 922 under Solomon's son Rehoboam and a northern Ephraimic labor leader, Jeroboam. Now, Jeroboam the first is the one who set up the golden calves at Dan and Bethel and started the nation of, we know as Israel, Ephraim, Samaria, on its downhill slide until they were taken in captivity in 722 under Assyria. But we're going to restore those. There's a few dates. If you'll just remember them, it'll set the whole Old Testament in perspective. 922, the kingdom split. 722, Israel, the northern 10 tribes, fell. 586, Judah finally fell completely to Babylon. 538, Cyrus restores the Jews to the homeland. 922, 722, 586, 538. If you remember those prophetic books, those historical books will fit into perspective. Now, this word one in verse 17. He says, put two sticks together in your hand and make them one stick. Now, this word one is exactly the same word used in Genesis 2:24, for a man shall leave father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall become one. So there's a form of the Hebrew word one with the potential for plurality. This is exactly the form that's found in the great monotheistic prayer of Judaism called the Shema from Deuteronomy 6, 4 and 5 and 6. Right through there. Hear, O Israel, the Lord thy God is one Lord. And it's the word for one with the possibility of plurality. There is another form that is used for one and only one, but this is not it. So this gives an insight into the plurality of God, even the Old Testament. Now, when I say plurality of God, you must listen to what I'm saying. I do not believe in three gods. I am not a tritheist. I am a monotheist. But if Jesus really is God and the Holy Spirit really is a personality, whether I like it or not, I've got one God with three manifestations or persona or personality or whatever you call it. I've got a triune unity. Best I can do. I got a tape on the Trinity. It's a good one. Old Testament, new references. Send for it. The tribes are going to be reunited, as emphasized throughout 15 down through 19 especially. Now, notice in verse 23 where it mentions, I will deliver you from all their dwelling places. Now, another possible reading here is the word backsliding, and that seems to fit the context better. Now, in verse 24 through 28 is this extremely important messianic reference that tells me we're talking about a future restoration. And my servant David, the servant's the honorific title for Moses and Joshua and David. It's the title that I think Paul uses, the slave of God in the New Testament. My servant David will be their king. Here's the messianic promises of a restored divinic line, 2 Samuel 7. And they will have one shepherd. Now here's the beautiful fulfillment of Jesus in John chapter 10 where he says, I am the good shepherd, picking up on a title for God from Psalms 23 and Isaiah 40 verse 11 and all those places. So here we have the titles of God in the Old Testament applied to Jesus. And Jesus did that on purpose. The author did it on purpose to assure his full deity. And they will walk in my ordinances and keep my statutes. There's that lifestyle faith that's so important. And they shall live in the land that I gave Jacob, my servant. And I want to show you something. I want you to look at me. Look in verse 25. You see the word forever in verse 25? You see the word everlasting in verse 26? There's another forever in verse 28. Now, I want to struggle with you. I don't have an answer here. I want to lay it out to you and let you think. I do not believe that this refers completely to the exile. For as you know, it didn't last. They were certainly scattered and Jerusalem was destroyed again in A.D. 70 under Titus. Only since 1947 has their homeland for the Jews been back in place. So I don't think all these forevers can refer to the restoration. Now, it's possible that there was meant to be a forever restoration, but the Jews broke the covenant again. That's possible. I also don't believe this can refer to a millennial reign. Because you see, in Daniel 12, it talks about an everlasting kingdom. That's what was given to in Daniel 7:13. It was given to him an everlasting kingdom. Now, there seems to be a real tension for me between the Old Testament emphasis on an everlasting kingdom that is physical in nature. And by that, Isaiah 11 to me, about a recreated earth with animals and men and fellowship with God, it seems to me that we're not so much going to heaven, heaven's coming to us. And it begins in a garden with the animals and man and God in Genesis 1. It ends in a garden, Revelation 22, with man back in a garden, restored with God. Now, possibly, Revelation 20, there is a period of the earthly millennial reign of Christ to fulfill something of the prophecies. I understand that. But in this context, the repeated emphasis on forever tells me that this is not a reference to a millennial restoration of the Jews. I have a real problem with people ripping Ezekiel out of its historical context and ripping Revelation out of its historical context and making it only apply to some future generation. I think Ezekiel said something to the exiles, and I think Revelation said something to the persecuted church of the first century. I'm not saying it totally exhausted the meaning of those two books or chapters, but it must start there. It must start there. Don't be so committed to someone's eschatological system that you miss the historical flow. It bothers me to make Revelation a totally Jewish book. It's not. It bothers me to split the Bible into that which refers to Israel and that which refers to the church. I see one covenant. Now, God can do whatever He wants to, and there are certainly some passages about a literal physical reign of Christ. I don't know how it's all going to work out. I want to take the Bible literally. I want to take it seriously, but I want to put the overall flow of this message. And this messianic reference, in my opinion, simply cannot refer exhaustively to the exile's return under Cyrus in 538, or the millennial reign of Christ mentioned in Revelation 20. It seems to be the eternal aspect here of a kingdom set up and then never to be fallen. And it is a physical, very physical kingdom. I'm really saying that animals will be a part of heaven. I'm not saying your pet will be there, but I am saying animals will be a part. And I think God and man in fellowship amidst a natural world seems to be God's plan from the very beginning. I don't know whether you buy that or not. I have through the years found that reading the Bible will throw a lot of light on men's views about prophecy. Prophecy is so difficult. It is so hard to lock down. We love the Bible so much, we want to take it so seriously that we tend to take it more literally than we're meant to. If you look at the disciples, when Jesus taught them, their tendency was to take Jesus too literally. And he had to come back and say, that's not what I meant. I meant da-da-da-da-da. Be careful about taking the Bible so literally that you miss the flow of the message. There needs to be a historical focus, and here, a future focus. A good example of that would be the virgin birth in Isaiah 14. There had to be a physical birth in Isaiah's day to fulfill that to the king. There was also a future orientation of the virgin birth of the Messiah. But I don't believe in two virgin births. I don't mean there's a virgin birth in Ahaz's day and then a virgin birth in Bethlehem. I believe in one virgin birth. That's why the Hebrew word behemoth is so neutral. It can be young woman or can be virgin. The same historical foreshadowing is here. So be real careful about reading your full-blown eschatological millennial positions into Ezekiel. This is national restoration. It refers primarily to the exiles, but it goes beyond that. It goes beyond that to something more, something ultimate. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you. I hope that this study has helped you. I hope it'll cause you to go back and look at the historical context and then look at the overall fulfillment. If you can keep both of them together without letting your preconceived biases interpret the text, it'll be a great day. I have those glasses. They're so hard to get off. But I'm trying. I hope you will. Pray for me. God bless you. I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week.